Hello, everyone. We have a really wonderful talk today with Dad and Mark Stevenson. And I noticed, Dad, it was really lovely to see you seeming very peppy and optimistic during the talk, which I liked a lot. Would you introduce
When I read Mark's book, it was brilliant. I've been obsessed with the future since a child. My childhood dream was to design the future. And we started in the mid 80s, no, late 70s, to put together a project about the future with Chris Hawes and William Woolard, who did Tomorrow's World. But it was too expensive. Everything had to be made back then. And I was thinking about reviving the project when I came across Mark's book. And it was so perfect because it doesn't hide the terrific and terrifying problems that the world is facing, but it does show that there's multiple solutions. We're still in trouble if we don't take them, but there are solutions. There is a way out. And as Mark says, if we never invent another thing, there is already existing solutions to all the major problems, from global warming, famine, shortages of water, pollution. There are solutions to it all. We just have to get our act together and do it. But the optimism in the book was fantastic. And I loved it. And he's since done another book called We Do Things Differently, which is slightly different, but brilliant. So I definitely recommend you go and get those books immediately.
Well, his first book, he
Mark
didn't
was a
say
fascinating.
the name.
Sorry?
His first book, he didn't say the name. It's called An Optimist Tour of the Future.
Oh, yes, An Optimist Tour of the Future, though I did show
Yes, this is a podcast, though.
it. And I met Mark because about the time I read the book, he did a talk in Lewis, and both Freya and I went to the talk. We talked to him about our project. He's a brilliant talker and he's doing incredible work. And I just thought it'd be lovely to talk to him here.
It was nice for me actually, because at the same time, I was just starting my master's in art and science, and we were to find a branch of science that we found interesting and get together with the researchers and come up with a project. And I was really stuck about what I would want to do. And I read Mark's book and I got really excited, particularly the bit about the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford, where they were looking into transhumanism and human enhancement technology. So that was what I based my project on and went over there and met some amazing people. And Mark was really nice and sort of sent me tips and things that I should include, and came to my end of year show as well and gave me some great talking tips as well, such as walking on stage smiling already. I've forgotten the other ones, but I know they were good because I got through and it's still watchable online without me dying of embarrassment, which is a good sign. But yeah, and it was really nice for me to see like you two talking as well. Like, it's just got a really positive feeling watching you guys talk about these things. So that was really nice too. And if you listen very carefully at the end, you can hear Mark throwing me under the bus. So listen out for that. And thank you, Mark. You bugger.
Mark is a very nice guy. Here's Mark. Okay, are we recording?
It says so here.
Yes, we're recording. Anyway, brilliant to see you again.
Love to see you, Roger.
The thing that really I really loved about your work was that it was sending a message of hope, which seemed to me to be a much more powerful engine than fear.
Right.
So
Donald Trump would disagree with you, Roger.
Yes. Well, what can I say? Solutions rather than emphasizing the problems.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, I always like to say that cynicism is obedience to the status quo. And it's also kind of laziness dressed up as wisdom. So it's very easy to say what's wrong with the world, because there's a lot wrong with it, first off. So it's easy to sort of say that. And it's also easy to say, and there's nothing to be done, and it's all those people's fault over there. And that just becomes an excuse for not doing things or making enemies. And as we all know, that doesn't really progress things very much. So I'm much more of the engineering mindset, which is, well, okay, what are we going to build? And I always think, you know, the way that engineers tend to think is when there's a problem, they go, great, fantastic, how can we fix that? Great time to be alive, got something interesting to do. Whereas politicians generally go, oh, there's a problem, who's going to win this argument and who do I have to sort of destroy in the process so that my view becomes prevalent? And I believe the human race at the end of the day, when you balance it out, is a co-inspirational network. So our fates are correlated, we go up or down together. And if you look at history in the broadest sense, we have collaborated more than we have not collaborated, because otherwise there'd be no way that Roger Dean and Mark Stevenson could be having a Zoom call, because millions of people over time have had to collaborate to the point where technology and society has got to this point. So I'm always looking for solutions, really, and I think it's a great relief for people, because people kind of go, oh, it's all pointless, it's all rubbish, it's a general narrative, it's either that way or that way. Whereas actually all I'm doing is going, look, here are a bunch of people who are working together to solve this problem that we all agree is a problem, and here's how it's working, and here's how it's prevailing, and what can we learn from them, and how do we spread that message of collaboration and co-inspiration rather than divisiveness. And you know, there's a huge hunger for that at the moment, because it just feels so relentlessly negative everywhere else that I find that approach is almost like, you know, a nice warm bath after being out in the rain for a long time.
Let me put this idea to you about solutions then. All the things we've been worrying about, climate change, pollution, all those big issues, insufficient food, insufficient water, there look to be many solutions, not one, but many, many solutions in the embryonic stage, and some of them more advanced. But the one problem that has to be solved before any of these are effective, I guess, is how do we motivate our politicians to go for this collaborative better future? How do we demand and get better?
So there's several ways of answering that, and that answer in and of itself could take several days. The first thing I would say is, a lot of people spend a lot of time thinking, how do we motivate politicians? And I say this as somebody who works with government, so it's not something that I also do that. But I think they often use it as an excuse for not to do what they're doing, what they should do where they are. So I'm a great believer of Gandhi's, you know, be the change you want to see in the world. You can spend a lot of time worrying about how to motivate politicians and totally ignore your local community or your backyard. Hmm. So the first thing to do is get on and do what you can where you are with what you've got, and make it possible, because that ripples out. And actually that will ripple out to your community, and that will ripple out to your local councillor, and that will ripple out, you know, if that sort of thing happens. And you see lots of that kind of stuff happening in places around the world, where communities have decided to just act locally and get together. The other thing to realize, and the reason I say that, is because history teaches us that politicians don't lead. Politicians follow. They follow what's going on. They're out there sniffing for, well, okay, what's going on? What's a vote winner? What is popular with my electorate? And so if the electorate is going over in that direction, they will follow. And we've certainly seen that now with climate change. It's not that the leaders got together and just, you know, gave us a direction of travel. Now enough people, thanks to people like Extinction Rebellion and other people, have got put it high up the agenda. And the COVID crisis has, you know, raised people's knowledge of the interconnectedness of all our fates. And so people are much more worried about the social contract, climate change, global crises, if there's going to be another pandemic because of our relationship with nature, all that kind of stuff. So now you're seeing this, you know, in my world, you're seeing a huge drive forward for climate action. You know, Boris Johnson is all over it, you know, which is really interesting, because lots of my friends on the left are going, oh, blah, 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 blah. And I'm going, what's the problem? Surely this is what you wanted. Didn't you want, you know, to get to the point where the right, you know, were as, you know, passionate about the climate as you were. So I think, you know, how do we convince them? By making the changes ourselves and showing a better way. And you know, I always think the power of example, you know, if you go to people and go, look, here's something that works and it's a win-win-win politically, economically, socially, financially, then let's do it that way. Whereas you can spend all your time going, how am I going to convince politician on the left or politician on the right of my particular worldview? And of course, you're going to get nowhere with that because they're assailed by that stuff all the time. What you want is demonstrations and exemplars of stuff that just works, that they can go, that's brilliant, looks fantastic, people love it, looks like a vote winner, you know, let's crack on. So I think it's often an excuse to use. How am I going to convince somebody else? I often find this with like another example is people often say, yeah, it's all very well dealing with climate change, but how are we going to convince all those Indians or all those Chinese people to do something about it? And it's kind of like, actually, you're in a much more privileged position than a lot of those poor people you're talking about. So it's your duty and responsibility, with, as you have privilege, to do the heavy lifting on this. That they're actually busy trying to, you know, get to Friday. You have, you know, so you're just, again, absolving your responsibility. And it's always very easy to say, I will change when those people over there change, or when those people over there are convinced, or somebody else has made an argument. And all the people I know that are successful in making change happen actually just get on and do it where they are with what they've got, and their influence grows, and suddenly they find themselves shaping opinion because of the amazing stuff they've done.
Sounds brilliant to me.
I mean, it's not rocket science, I think. You know, I've just gone about a very long way of doing exactly what Gandhi said, which is be the change you want to see in the world.
Right. When I read your book, because you know that we've been looking at projects based on the future, going back to the 80s, but when I read your book, I thought, my God, this nails it, because this is about solutions that are happening, and it's about what I just said. It's about hope. It's about this can be achieved. And that was much more motivating than, my God, look what's coming down the pipe.
Yeah. I mean, it can be. Whether it will be, I don't know. I mean, I'm a possibilist, really. So what I'm saying is it's perfectly possible that we could have a bright, sustainable, indeed regenerative future. And it's perfectly possible we could have a dreadful dystopian one. I just know which side I'm on. I mean, the thing that keeps me motivated quite a lot is a quote from my very good friend, Ed Gillespie, who's another kind of, I guess, reluctant futurist like myself. And we have a podcast together with John Richardson, the comedian, where we talk about all these issues. And he says this brilliant thing. He says, if you want to change the world or subvert the status quo, then you have to have more fun than they are and let them know you're having more fun while you're doing it. So I think it's always important to realize if you're trying to battle the forces of evil, to make sure you're having better parties, better cocktails, and more sex with more interesting people more often. Because that will bring a lot of people in your direction. And what's been wrong with a lot of activism, you know, progressive activism, is it's like everything's terrible, you're all awful, and you've got to give up everything in your life and prostrate yourself against the great God of giving everything up and being incredibly virtuous. And of course, that's not massively attractive to a lot of people, and it's very tiring.
But weirdly, a lot of people tend to believe that as a default position, that the future must be smaller, meaner, and less comfortable.
Yeah, and I you can see where that comes from, because our predominant narratives are so bipartisan. It's kind of like you either go this way or that way. And whenever, if you go that way, it's dreadful. So if you're on the left, you say, if you go in the direction of, you know, of more individualism and free markets and capitalism and all that kind of stuff, it's just dreadful. It's just awful. Everything's going to go horribly, horribly wrong. And there is some parts of that argument where they're right, but there are some other parts where they're completely wrong. And conversely, you know, if you're on the right, people on the left go, oh, well, if you follow any kind of socialist agenda or blah, blah, it's just a disaster for society and freedom gets destroyed and we all have to live, you know, in Hessian and sackcloth. It's like, well, no, that's not true either. So I think we're forced into this frame of reference, which is you choose one way or the other, and one way is righteous and one way is just the end of humanity. And of course, that's ridiculous when you look at it. I mean, I often think of that great William Burroughs quote. She said, after one look at this planet, any visitor from outer space would say, I want to see the manager. Because the whole, you know, it's like, really? Is this how you manage your political debate? Is this how your media works? Is this how you've arranged things so that you cannot actually even begin to talk properly about the problems you've got together, which you all share, but rather than work together, you decide to kick, you know, kick 7 bells of hell out of each other. It's kind of ridiculous, and I have no time for it, really. And so I remain resolutely a religious, a political, a everything in my work, not because I don't have views on spirituality or the way business should work, but I know that to make any kind of change, you need a diverse coalition of people. And actually, some of the people I disagree with have knowledge that fills in my blind spots. So it's really important to look at everybody as part of the solution rather than look at half of them as part of the problem.
My father was army. He was an engineer in the Remi.
Yes, and my grandfather was as well. So there we go. Maybe they work together. Who knows?
Well, briefly, between Cyprus and Hong Kong, we stayed in Wiltshire, which was in Bulford Army Camp. It was a huge military base. And there was a lot of protests even then about how much land was given over to the army. And my dad said, you know what? There's a higher density of wildlife in the army areas than there is outside of them. Because there's no farming, there's no pesticides, there's no building. It's just allowed to go fallow. Excuse me. And for a lot of the meadow plants and things like that, it was perfect environment on a large scale.
Yeah, it's interesting you mention that, because I'm working with the MOD at the moment, and indeed the UN, on paramilitary cooperation on climate change. So the government, I mean, all the governments of the world are basically saying we need to get to net zero by 2050. Pretty much every nation in the world therefore needs its military to get to net zero. So in the UK, for instance, half of the government's emissions are from the MOD. So if the MOD doesn't get to net zero, then the government itself can't. I'm not talking about the country, but the government as an institution cannot meet its own ambitions if the military doesn't come along. And what's interesting is that they do own quite a lot of land. And one of the ways they're looking at getting to net zero is how they manage that land by using it to sequester carbon, which is fascinating stuff. It's odd for me working with the military. I mean, I'm a lifelong pacifist, really. And it's not somebody that, you know, having been big in environmentalism and social cohesion, a lot of people go, well, how are you sitting with those guys? But it's like, well, they need to come along too. And they've got a lot of influence. And one thing I'm particularly working on is getting militaries to agree with each other that climate change is a threat that they all have to face together. So that we cannot protect your national security without protecting, sorry, we cannot protect our national security without protecting yours. So I'm working on a declaration for a bunch of the world's militaries to be signed at the next climate change meeting, where they all agree with each other that they have to work together on climate change initiatives, you know, which is extraordinary, you know, and also that in itself changes the debate about climate change in the wider world. So I don't know how we got there, but you know, it's interesting the diversity of people you have to involve to solve any problem, and all the research is in on this. Diversity of all forms and innovation go hand in hand. The more diverse an audience you have, and I don't just mean in terms of cultural or ethnic diversity, but also neurodiversity and approaches, you know, that the more diverse an audience you have looking at a problem, the better the result, which of course is, you know, it does, because you've got all those different viewpoints working on it and arguing it out and finding a solution together. So it's strange now, as we face these massive challenges, the answer is not more and more partisanship and going down one particular route. It's actually more diversity. You know, in my second book, one of the great quotes about democracy was somebody said, democracy's problems are not solved by less democracy, they're solved by more democracy, more local democracy, more participatory democracy, by getting more people involved in smaller and smaller things, more and more locally. And so that's, you know, bringing these coalitions together is the way we get out of these problems. Actually, you know, we are our own solution, if only we can get over this stupid partisan nonsense and realize that we have more in common than we don't.
I particularly liked in your second book the story about the head teacher.
Oh yes, the wonderful car.
Education, particularly art education, but education in general, has often seemed to me to be less than it should be. So this
understatement of the year from Roger Dean there.
Well, I practice them.
I mean, it is because, you know, since if you look at economic education, for instance, talking about economics, well, we're still teaching you know, supply and demand and Keynesian economics and whatever. And none of that accounts for the environment, the planet, the operating system of any economy. So it doesn't account for any of the flows that go out of an economy, you know, into the rivers or into the air, which will eventually destroy the economy if you don't do anything about it.
We may so be on a sort of a grand scale, we may be teaching that, but on a individual scale, we aren't teaching kids how to balance an account or anything to do with money, actually.
Well, yeah, but also you can't teach them anything about money unless you teach them about value. So, for instance, if you look at GDP as a measure, the guy who invented it said, you know, I can tell you the value of the trees, the timber of the trees you cut down, but this doesn't measure the value of the forest that you lost. And therefore, that bigger picture of how we account for things is very, very badly done. And so the whole G20 is based on a false accounting system that doesn't really take account of the environment. And if we don't take account of the environment, we all die. So the whole education system is based around things you can easily measure. And of course, as you know, particularly as an artist, a lot of the things that are really valuable are things that are impossible to measure, but are very easy to discern. And so we need a wider approach. And again, education for me is often about answers. Do you know the answer? And for me, a good education is about, do you know how to ask a really good question? Because you can phrase the question well, then the answer often comes quite quickly. But if you phrase the question badly, or you don't even know how to phrase a question, then you end up with bad answers, obviously. Excuse the profanity, but there's a great quote from Thomas Pynchon, the American author, in his book, Gravity's Rainbow. He wrote, if they get you asking the wrong questions, they don't give a fuck about the answers.
Yes. Talking about other authors, I'm trying to remember his name, a Dutch author who wrote a book.
Oh, Rutger Bregman.
Yes.
Yeah, Utopia for Realists.
Yes, I liked his first story about everyone having a minimum income. That seemed to be incredibly logical.
Mm.
I didn't agree with a lot he said in the rest of the book, but that first thing, I thought that needed exploring. It had such a powerful common sense.
Yeah, and strangely, out of the pandemic, the Spanish government are adopting that for some of their poorer citizens as a national strategy, I understand.
Really?
And it was Richard Nixon, actually, of all people, who nearly brought that to fruition in America in the 60s. He was it was the Democrats who opposed it. So, you know, it's a very interesting idea. The studies seem to show that. So the big fear, of course, is if you give people, you know, a basic income that meets all their sort of, so that they can eat and clothe themselves and shelter themselves without having to work. Then, you know, the popular narrative is, you know, and I think there's a bit of our brains that all of us go like, well, people just sit at home masturbating and eating Watsits, won't they? And it's like, no, what it turns out is actually people use that platform to do all the things that most of us want to do, which is to find meaning and work and you know, some people abuse it, as always do, but actually 95% of people, you know, it benefits the economy because you have less stress, you have less mental health problems, you have less public health problems, you have better looked after children, etc. So it does make sense, but part of the problem we have with all of these new ideas is that they come into a frame of reference where everybody sees the world's acting in a particular way. I remember my good friend Tony Lovell, who I wrote about in the first book, he said, how do you think the person who cut down the last tree on Easter Island felt? And I responded, I said, oh, I suppose they felt terrible. And he went, no. He said they'd grown up in a world without trees. This was an odd thing that just needed to be got rid of, because that was their frame of reference. So to them, a tree was like an oddity. Why would you want one of those? You know, they're so rare, and you know, you don't really need that tree. And I think it's the same with all these new ideas, that you come into a frame of reference where you can't even see its merits, because the way you've been thinking about it since the get-go is within this particular set of constraints, which you accept absolutely normal and the natural order of things. I was working yesterday with a large organization that I'm trying to reform. And I was reminded of a quote by Machiavelli. And he wrote it in The Prince, his famous treatise on politics. It says, it ought to be remembered that there is nothing more difficult to take in hand, more perilous to conduct, or more uncertain in its success than to take the lead in the introduction of the new order of things. Because the innovator has for enemies all those who have done well under the old conditions, and lukewarm defenders in those who may do well under the new. This coolness arises partly from the fear of opponents who have the laws on their side, and partly from the incredulity of men who do not readily believe in new things until they've had long experience of them.
Yeah.
So it's like, we're safe where we were comfortable, where we're better the devil you know, quite a lot of the time. So it takes, so I spend a lot of my time working with innovators who were able to break that frame. And that's, in a way you did that, Roger, when you think about it. You know, when you came along with your extraordinary paintings and art, you broke the frame of what was possible. And I know, Fletch, you've interviewed Ian McCabe on this show. And I remember him telling me that, you know, it would have been impossible for him, and in fact for anything that happened, you know, in the Star Wars world in terms of art, for instance, to have happened without you, because you came along. It's like, wow, everything changed. And so, in the world of economics at the moment, it's a lady called Kate Raworth, and I think she's like the Roger Dean of Kate Raworth. She's just coming along going, hang on, what about this much bigger, more expansive, more exciting way of thinking about this thing? And so you need those people. And, that's the power of great art. And I use that in the broadest sense, the ability to see the new and make it real for people such that they can feel it, touch it, and feel it most importantly. And that's a hard task. And most people try to convince us by convincing our intellect. And I'm a big geek, so I'm a big fan of intellect and figures and kicking the tires on things and being very skeptical about stuff until it's there. But I do know that the brain does the PR for what the heart has already decided. And if you can't move the heart, then you've got a real problem in how any kind of level of systems change. And none of our public discourse is really based around, as you say, an emotional engagement with a better future. The emotions we are asked to invoke are ones of fear and distrust of anything that looks a bit different.
Well, the one good thing about dystopian visions of the future are change is going to happen.
Yes.
What we're saying is, let's make a change for the better. We're saying the choice is worse or better. We can't do the same anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is, dystopian visions of the future are much more entertaining. I remember a story about Isaac Asimov. So he wrote the famous three laws of robotics in a short story for a science fiction magazine whose name I now forget. And in the story, he painted this picture of a future where the robots and the humans worked actually quite well together. There were a few problems or whatever, but it was a society of coalition. And the editor of the magazine went, "This is great, Isaac, but it's really dull. Where's the conflict?" You know, and so he wrote the next version of that story, to satisfy the first three laws of fiction, which is there must be conflict, there must be conflict, and there must be conflict. And, if you look at Hollywood movies, to talk about your great nemesis, James Cameron, nobody wants to go and see Terminator 4 Gardening Day, where the robots come back from the future to help you mow your lawn. You know, that's a really dull watch. So almost necessarily in the way we think about narratives, we think there must be conflict and we think there must be destruction and we think there must be this great existential threat and it must all be terrible. And then that's another frame that's actually not true. You can tell incredible stories of redemption and kindness that are just as compelling. But people don't believe that. And it's the same with the media. I've been sat, working with commissioning editors at various broadcasters who shall remain nameless, Channel 4, just going like, well, it's all very interesting, but nobody's going to be interested in a world where things work. They need conflict. It's like, no, I think people are really just in a world where things work, actually. I think they'd be fascinated by it, but they just cannot get their head around that.
That's crazy. That really is crazy, because a fantastic vision of the future is what's going to motivate us and our children into building it.
Yeah. I think it should also, one of the things I live by this set of principles, which I call the 8 principles of successful optimists, which I've kind of distilled from observing, incredible, brilliant people like yourself. And one of those rules of the people that I think are successful and achieve great things is they have an optimism of ambition about the future, and that they do believe there is a better future out there and there's something to be done about making it. And I think a lot of people just don't have that. If you don't even start with the idea that the future can be better, then it's just a zero sum game where it gets no better or worse, or it's I win but they lose, then you're off to you've hampered yourself straight away. You have to absolutely believe that a better future is possible. And that's why, you know, it's important sometimes to show what that might look like. And in fact, I just had a discussion with a big American network yesterday about a show based around that kind of idea, where they said, what if we looked 20 years ahead and said, well, this is what it could look like. What would then be the steps to get there? And let's go and find those seeds now and sort of expose them and kind of go, well, there's a great Chinese proverb, which is the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The next best time is now. And so the idea of the show is like, well, let's go and show the tree in 20 years time, and let's go and find where the seeds are being planted today so that people can see a roadmap to a future that's actually functional. And it's not a utopian future. I'm very much against utopianism because I think it paints a false hope. It'll still be a lived in future with you know, all its problems and trials and whatever, but it'll be a one where we haven't destroyed the entire planet, which I think is a win on, you know, on balance.
Yes. I'm going to take you back to that headmaster because I love that.
But yes.
We never talked about creativity, and that headmaster, in challenging the way his school was taught, brought in ideas. Hmm. How did that, I mean, we didn't talk about that. But I mean, one of the things that I think is profoundly possible and necessary is to get people to think more creatively. And I think that can be taught, and it needs to be.
Well, I mean, do you think it can be taught, or do you think we're taught out of it? So there's the famous Ken Robinson speech where he says, you know, we're not taught into our creativity, we're actually taught out of it. Picasso, doesn't he, said that wonderful thing to, you know, to talk. I feel very, I feel terrible now talking to obviously a world-renowned artist about art, because I feel a complete sham. But Picasso said, you know, every child is an artist. The problem is how to remain one as you grow up.
Yes,
was it Salvador Dali who said, you know, I spent my entire life learning to paint like an adult and spent my entire adult life trying to paint like a child, or whatever, or something like that. So I think, and I, you know, I've got two young children now, both under the age of five. And, you know, I have to constantly stop myself from stifling their creativity because they've got so much of it. And it's just about, it's not so much about educating them into it. It's just like, how can I guide this wonderful force in a way it doesn't restrict them, but gives them, you know, a bit more fuel for that creativity in a positive direction. So I don't think you can certainly be given tools and techniques to come up with different ideas, but I think we're all naturally creative to begin with, and it's kind of beaten out of us.
Well, then let's rephrase that. If we can be taught how to re-engage, then.
Yeah.
In any event, it's teachable. And I think the literal way we are taught at school is necessary, but it's only part of the picture, a small part. Yeah.
It is a very small, no, I suppose it's half the picture. I think that there's, again, in education, you see this terrible and ridiculous partisanship between what is largely called traditionalists and progressives. And traditionalists have the argument, which is, look, there's a right way of doing things. And again, I'll get this wrong. So anybody on that side of the argument, I'm obviously necessarily paraphrasing this because I don't want to get a load of emails going, you bastard, from either side of the argument, which is what often happens. But in a broad brush way, the traditionists will say, look, there's an accepted canon of knowledge. There's an accepted way of doing things. Lots of people have worked a very long time to get to this point where, you know, we've learned this stuff. And it's probably really worth you learning that and knowing it back to front, because that's a foundation upon which everything else is built.
Yeah. You know?
And that makes perfect sense. Okay. And then the progressives on the sense go, well, actually, what education is really about is throwing everything up in the air and kind of asking a whole bunch of new questions and getting ourselves to learn to work together and question things differently. And it's not so much about the knowledge, it's about the creativity and the human potential. And of course, those two things work perfectly well together. They are both entirely necessary. But again, this ridiculous bipartisanship says we must go completely to one. And the thing is, for the traditionalists, it's slightly easier, because you can measure that kind of stuff. You can measure very easily whether somebody knows how to add up, or whether their grammar is good, or whether they know the second law of thermodynamics or whatever, because they can write it down and explain it. You know, you can measure that stuff, so it's easy to examine. It is much harder to measure in a consistent way whether somebody has empathy or knows how to ask a question or can work in a team, all that kind of stuff. And therefore that stuff's not examined. And so it makes it harder for the progressives to get in there, because we manage what we can measure. And governments.
I'm not against the basic tools. I think you need the basic tools. Absolutely you do.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, learning the craft of art is critical, and that art schools abandoned that in the 60s is shameful. Yeah. But it isn't everything, but it is an important backbone.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember a great quote from Grayson Perry. He said it was, because he's actually a very, very skilled artist. He's an incredibly talented, craftsman as well. And he said it was harder for him to come out as a craftsperson to say, oh, this stuff is really important, than it was to come out as a transvestite. in the art community, he said, it was actually tougher for me to actually say, look, these basic skills and the craft of it is really important, than it was to turn up in a dress.
Yes, it is a hard thing to say, because the whole art world has gone against it, tragically, in my view.
Yeah, because, well, again, it's this ridiculousness of it's one way or the other. And of course, it's both. All of us know that.
It has to be both. I'm going to repeat myself here, but because it's relevant, I will. I was teaching some students who'd asked me to give a talk on drawing. And they were in a school where conceptual art was being taught as the god of art. And I remember going through explaining how I learned to draw. And one of the teachers stood up and said, well, I suppose you think art is all about technique. And I said, no, but you can't have great art without great craftsmanship. You have to have that physical learning as part of the process, because training the hand trains the mind. That's a quote from Kendo, but it's absolutely true. If you train the hand, you can train the mind. And it's true of drawing, playing the violin, or whatever. If you're not that terrific amount of real estate that you've got up here that's devoted to hand-eye coordination, is needs practice and training.
Yeah, I often think that some of the most creative people I know are often musicians somewhere else, or artists. You know, you find out you'd be working with an amazing diplomat or scientist or whatever, and you actually find out that they're an incredible musician or artist on the side as well, because they're, you know, that ability to coordinate your body and your mind is a fantastic wholeness. You know, you become much more whole, I think, in those moments. And, you know, we definitely see it when we see a great musician performing. You see all the intellect and all the art and all the physicality coming together at once. And that's what you want. You want a human being at their optimum, not just a part of themselves.
Yes. And I think creativity and science and art and literature all have that same source.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is being a whole human. And again, back to our conversation about education, you know, there are some arguments that, yes, why you would separate the world up into subjects. But actually, we all know the interesting stuff is in the interplay of the subjects. That's where all the action is. It's where the science and the art and the history and the politics meet. That's the stuff they absolutely separate out and say, oh, no, you can't ask that question. That question's not on the curriculum. Stop it. It's annoying.
There's a lot that aren't, by the way, for that reason. You know, there's not known answers.
Yeah, and that's good. That's good, you know. When I'm doing my strategy work with my various clients, I reframe their strategies, whether they're NGOs or government departments or corporations, and saying, you know, stop giving yourself destinations and give yourself a set of questions that you're constantly trying to answer. That will give you the flexibility to move forward into an uncertain world, but a direction of travel, which is we are always trying to say. So, for instance, one of my clients recently who works in the housing sector, they've changed their corporate strategy to a single question, which is, what is our maximum effect on reducing loneliness? And that of course shifts depending on whether you're in a pandemic or not, or what the government's doing, or blah, blah, blah. So, you know, I think that's a much better way of approaching the world, is having a bunch of questions that you're constantly trying to answer, to which there is probably no one answer.
Or there's presumed answers. You mentioned law of thermodynamics. Do you know it, by the way?
What, the second law of thermodynamics?
Right.
Well, in summary, everything gets worse. You know, we're all going to die eventually. You know, everything is going to even out, and there'll be an inexorable heat death of the universe, so everything's pointless, is one way of interpreting it.
How was it written down?
I can't. Now you're what? In mathematically, you're talking, or is...
Yeah, no. I was just teasing you. That we won't go there.
Okay.
But I do remember Eric Lathwaite used to get very agitated about the law that says for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction.
Right. We had a problem with Newton, did he?
Yes. Basically, that he said, but that doesn't take into account induction and motors. It doesn't take into account gyroscopes, because they move, you know, you have a spinning gyroscope, and you push it that way, it will want to move that way.
Hmm.
So it has an equal reaction, but it's not opposite.
Ah, well, it depends whether we're talking about in the Newtonian realm or the quantum realm. And this is the big theory of everything that they're trying to make at the moment, isn't it? But I'm not, yeah, let's not get, I'm going to start losing my grip if we go into quantum mechanics. I mean, I know a little bit, but not enough to argue with one of the world's greatest artists.
Well, then, and I know nothing. So there you go.
There we go. It'd be like Fox News, two people who know nothing about the subject talking to each other as if they've got an opinion.
Are you making enemies here?
Maybe. Yes, you're right. Yeah, edit that out.
I'm gonna say something different. We've run for 50 minutes. So no. I'm gonna say we'll stop here and continue for a few minutes if you're up for it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So I'm going to tell Hugh, who does the puts these together, that he can edit at that point.
Yeah. Or edit down. I mean, you know, you might want to take 20 minutes out, and then we'll be under the 50 minutes. So,
what are you working on now? Are you doing a new book?
I keep trying to. It's quite difficult. I've got a new book that a lot of publishers are interested in, and I just have not found the time to do it. So the book is called Their Time Has Come, Ideas from the Past That Will Save the Future. So it's about new ideas that are coming together now, or meeting each other, but they have their roots back in history. So it's about tracing those roots from ancient Assyria to the modern world, and how that linked with something that came from, I don't know, the Roman Empire, creates a new idea that is one that will help us solve some of the problems of the future.
Interesting, because you quoted Nixon trying to introduce that idea of a universal minimum wage.
Yeah.
And he was swamped by a guy in his own party who quoted an attempt in the UK to do just that several hundred years earlier.
Yeah, I mean, the idea's been around for a long time. And the premise of the book is, you know, there's a great quote by Victor Hugo, which is, nothing is so powerful as an idea whose time has come. And the premise of the book is really actually nothing is so powerful as two or three ideas whose time has come when they meet together, you know. So, but you're seeing that now with the climate change argument. You know, it's really interesting that the discussions I'm having with military forces around the world, I have a call with NATO next week, for instance, is that climate change has arrived and it's not going away. They are now thinking about, okay, how do we deal with this most terrible threat to our citizens, which we are sworn to protect, and realizing they can't do it separately. You know, and that idea has finally arrived. As I say, Boris Johnson is now an advocate for it. You know, so it's quite an interesting time to be alive, because lots of ideas, time is coming at the moment. The election of Biden is interesting as well, in what that says about democracy and how it needs to be rebuilt. But we'll get there, I think. it just depends on how many of us we are able to take with us safely. And with the climate change argument, we might not be able to save everybody because so many of the tipping points are already in action.
Talking about climate change, though, how much emphasis is put on to just getting to zero emissions, and how much thought into building a global thermostat?
Mm. Well, I think the what's happening now is people have gone away, are going away from the idea of sustainability, which is keeping things as they are, to what you would call regenerativeness. So actually not how do we just keep it okay or keep it below a certain level, but how do we actually put back everything we've taken out? How do we use our expertise to, you know, rebuild ecosystems and rebuild biodiversity such that you have a net positive impact? So at the moment, the human race has had a net negative impact on the environment because what it's done is it's taken so much out for its own self that it's thrived quite a lot, but it's now, you know, reaching the limits where it suddenly realized like, oh, if I destroy my own spaceship, I'm in trouble. So now I think a lot of the debate is going to be, okay, how in what we do inside the spaceship, do we also improve the spaceship as well and make it more robust and whatever? So yeah. I think that phraseology is certainly dominant in a lot of the work I'm doing at the moment. I've just helped do a strategy for a very large corporation, and they're now determined that there will be the first regenerative organization in their industry. So they will put more back into the environment, and indeed, they said more back into the communities in which they work than they take out. And that's their stated business strategy now. So I think that will be the thing that will happen over the next 10 or 15 years. You'll see the word sustainability disappear and the word regeneration become much more the direction of travel, which is great.
Right, because just levelling off the carbon emissions is not enough, is it?
No, we have to take a whole bunch out. You know, we've got to take a huge amount out, and the industry we have to build to do that will be bigger than the current oil and gas industry. So I'm working on something at the moment called the United Nations Planetary Health Institute, which is hoping to accelerate that kind of stuff. And again, strange coalitions of partners, because you actually have to go and talk to aviation. You have to go and talk to mining. You have to go and talk to
fossil fuels. Why aren't we looking at hydrogen-powered aircraft?
I think, well, we are. Some people, you know, I think Airbus came up with the three prototypes for hydrogen-powered aircraft only a couple of weeks ago. So
we did?
Yeah.
Good. Because the fuel is not only safer and lighter, but it doesn't do any damage.
Well, it's highly corrosive, hydrogen. That is a slight problem with it. And yes, but, you know, there are all these things that see, none of them are the answer. They're all parts of the answer. And there are certain situations where you want to use hydrogen and certain situations where you wouldn't. There are certain places you want to use solar and wind and all these other things. There are certain places where batteries work. One of the things I wrote about in my second book was liquid air battery storage. We're just about to have a massive liquid air battery plant built in the UK to help us have a sustainable storage system or regenerative storage system. So there's all these ideas out there. As I said at the end of my first book, we are not short of solutions.
No.
We would invent nothing more. We need not invent a single new thing to have a sustainable, equitable, humane, and just planet. But our problems are not technological. Our problems are ethical and moral. And what we need to put the work into is working at how we rethink our economies and our democracies and our institutions, including our art schools, Roger, to be part of a new idea of human thriving, which is based around cooperation, co-inspiration, where the individual can thrive within the collective rather than the individual thriving at the expense of the collective.
Yeah. We mentioned Hank at the beginning because he's very keen on global warming and finding solutions. He has a ranch in Hawaii, and on the workshop of his ranch, he's trying out all kinds of different solar panels. But on a good sunny day, they create enough electricity to run the ranch for a month. And he's got batteries. So he's got 6 months of power for his ranch stored. But he's still generating. Whatever he's doing, those solar panels keep on making electricity beyond his storage capacity. So he's making hydrogen.
Yes.
And he's now got quite a few 40-foot propane gas tanks of hydrogen.
I mean, about the frame of reference, when you think about energy, people talk about energy as if it's a finite resource, that we only have a small amount of it, and what's the most efficient way to do it, and how do you give it to people? Actually, we have more, I can't remember the statistic, but it's something like we have more energy hitting the Earth's surface in terms of solar energy an hour than we use in a year, or it might be a day that we use in a year, I can't remember, but what we're very bad at is capturing that energy. And so we can't bank it. So I like to say the sun is waving this massive energy paycheck in our face every second, and we can't bank it. There's no way to bank it. And then actually what we have done is we've gone into the only bank we do have, which is fossil fuels, which has taken millions of years of fossilized sunshine to sort of come down to these very energy dense materials. And we've run into that savings account that Mother Nature generously gave us, you know, with the gay abandon of a heroin addict with a credit card. And what we should be thinking of that fossil fuel savings account as a bootstrap, as a platform for us to develop the technology such that we can wave, so that we can bank the stuff that's coming in from the sun and from the wind and all that kind of stuff. And that's, so when we get that right, and the roadmap to that is I think fairly obvious, we won't have a lack of energy. Bob Metcalf, one of the co-inventors of the internet, says, you know, when we get that right, we won't have a lack of energy. We will have a squanderable abundance of it.
Yes.
And it'll be cheap.
It's like a science fiction story that talked about energy that was broadcast, so you didn't need cables.
Yeah, well, you can do that. It's one microwave. You can broadcast energy. One theory is, or one solution is, I mean, I'm not sure I particularly think this is a particularly viable one, but one idea is you stick satellites up in space with masses of solar panels. They collect stacks of solar energy and they beam it down to the Earth using microwave technology.
But guess what? You don't need to have those interlopers. You can take it direct from the sun.
Yeah, exactly. So, we'll end up, it'll be interesting. I think, you know, I try to imagine if I survive to see my grandchildren, they will kind of go, let me get this right, granddad, you know. So when you were a boy, they used to dig up the energy from the fossil fuels and burn it. And it was only 33% efficient. So you lost 67% of the heat, you know, of the energy in waste heat and friction. And it caused all these terrible wars because people were fighting over this stuff. And whilst you were burning it, it was heating up the planet, causing the worst existential risk to humanity ever. And you had to pay for it. Connect yourself to an end of a wire, and if you didn't pay your bill, they'd cut you off. Is that how the energy system used to work, granddad? And you go, yeah, that's kind of it. And they go, but granddad, it's coming out of the sky for free. And you go, yeah, I know. just a while ago, I had around it, you know.
We've all got a lot of explaining to do.
Yeah. I mean, we haven't even touched on the food system yet, but we haven't got time for that. So.
Yeah. Well, Mark, I want to do this again. So thank you very much for joining.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we should talk more about, we hardly talked about creativity at all.
No, and we've hardly talked about the ideas you and I, with Ian, tried to do to get that film / TV thing off the ground. Sadly, this year, Sid died.
Yes, I saw, I was very upset about that.
Yes.
I was always very, very touched that he occasionally would write me an email saying how much he liked my work. It was like, oh my God, Sid Mead sent me an email. You know, short of I don't know, David Gilmour dropping me a line. I'm not sure how much happier I could be.
David Gilmour hasn't dropped you a line? What's going on?
I don't know. It's outrageous, isn't it? Has he not read my work?
That's hardly believable.
Yes. Although we do share some common friends at Client Earth, so he's been funding Client Earth and I've been doing some work with Client Earth, so there's still a chance.
Right. Okay. So you still have your band, don't you?
Oh, I do. Yes, Quantum Pig. We have our second album is currently in the works. After a universally well-received first album, we didn't get a single bad review. But there again, I think it's because, you know, if you're in prog rock, it's kind of like a little cabal. It's a club, isn't it? Even if the people, it's like, we're so glad you're here, we're not going to criticize you. I always like to say that I think prog rock you know, being in a prog rock band in you know, nowadays is a bit like, I'd imagine what it's like, what it was like being gay in the 60s, which is, you know, there's a vast number of people who, you know, are in that space, but you don't really want to talk about it in polite company. Yeah. But when you do find the place, you know, the clubs or whatever, where you're allowed to express that thing, everybody's like, well, you know, I don't care whether we disagree on anything else, you're here, so we're going to be very nice to you because we're, you know, we're threatened. And I, in a way, I feel that prog rock is a bit like
Rick Wakeman made the joke about people going into a record store and asking for Yes or King Crimson and asking for it to be put in a brown bag.
Absolutely. I mean, another thing, my friend John Mitchell, who's in various prog rock bands, he says, what you have to understand is that prog rock is its own parody. Which I think is very knowing, you know, which is fine. So yes, no, the band is, we accidentally got a record deal and we have to do a second album, and it's going to be very good, I hope, if I can ever find the time to finish it. That's the problem. My poor co-writer, Ian, the wonderful Ian Farragher, keeps providing me with extraordinarily beautiful and wonderful pieces of music that I am desperately trying to turn into songs.
And you have to make the lyrics, do you?
I write the, well, it doesn't always work this way, but in general, he provides a lot of really, really great music and riffs and ideas and structures. And I create melody lines and lyrics and guitar solos and things to sit around that to make it a coherent thing.
Right.
It's a wonderful working partnership because he's a genius and he suffers with me. But, you know, eventually I grind through it and come up with something that's half decent, I think.
I would have thought you'd be brilliant at it because you do the books so well. I mean,
well,
the books were magical for me. They really, I thought, great, this is fantastic.
Well, you're very kind. Yes, I mean, people were very kind about the first album, and I'm very pleased with the second one. It's just, you know, with all the other work, you know, with the military and the trying to save the planet, sometimes the album gets put on the back burner somewhat.
Right. Well, we never
talked about it
either. So why don't we do this again and talk about the creativity and the music? And
yes, that would be lovely. Yes, and I think, yes, we could definitely talk about that. And I'd be very happy to.
Fantastic.
Excellent.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you, Roger. It was, you know, you cheered me up after a very difficult evening in that I spent most of the night awake with my one-year-old. Because we're trying to basically wean him off his mother having to get up every night to deal with him. So I'm going in there with a bottle of milk rather than her. And he's basically punching me in the face and telling me I'm the worst thing in the world and, screaming at me. And he did that for 2 hours last night. But it's, you know, we have to break him in to the point that, you know, because my poor Caroline is, you know, needs her sleep. So thanks for that. You've cheered me up because I woke up this morning feeling particularly grumpy, having not slept very well and having been roundly abused by a one-year-old for the best part of the evening.
Yes. Yes.
But you've been there. You know what that's like.
Yes, I didn't have the hard work, I don't think. It seemed wonderful. Actually, I don't know. You'll think it was wonderful too. Give it 24 hours.
Oh, no, I mean, no. It's, I think with parenting, the highs are higher and the lows are lower, aren't they? That's than other life.
Yeah.
Well, I was surprised that you wanted me on this podcast to talk about creativity, because I remember once when Freya thought she might want to ask me out. I think either you or she told me the story where she said to you, do you think it'd be all right if I asked out Mark? Because me being, you know, a bit older than that. And you said, well, you know, if you want to, but you do have to realize that Mark is the most visually literate person in the universe.
I never said that, did I?
You have to realize it is literally the most visually literate person I've ever met.
Oh, shit. Wow, you more than make up for it 100-fold in every other field. So.
Well, thank you very much. Right, now on that note, Roger, I actually have to go and do something incredibly dull now. I'd love to carry on speaking to you, but I've actually got to go and unblock a drain, and the weather has got to the point where it's not throwing it down, so I should probably go and do that now. So I'm going to go and unblock a drain.
How about creative interludes?
Sublime to the ridiculous, talking about creativity with one of the world's finest artists, unblocking a drain with a plunger. Such is life.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and when the lockdown is finished, we should get together for a drink or something. That'd be lovely.
Yes. I'm going to, I've recorded this. I'm going to send you a copy when it's within the next hour anyway.
Okay, brilliant. All right, I'll look forward to that. Yeah. And love to see you.
And you. Take good care.
All right. Cheers, Roger.
Bye-bye.